Hello, and welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.
This week, we're talking with Christopher Judd. Chris is CTO and partner at Manifest Solutions, author, Java user group leader, Java champion, trusted technical advisor, and talent developer. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Chris, before we get started, would you just give us a little bit of an introduction to who you are and perhaps how you got started in the industry?
Sure. So right now I'm the CTO and a partner at Manifest Solutions. I've been doing that for about 6 years now. And I really took on this role because I was excited to really bring up the next generation of software developers. And one of the things we do is a boot camp, and where we actually pay people to come learn how to write software. Now, unlike most of the other boot camps out there that take you from nothing to becoming proficient, we actually take people who have college degrees and really bring them to the next level and make them successful consultants. In addition to that, I'm a Java champion. I've co-authored 3 Java books and some DZone ref cards and a children's book. And one of the things I love doing is every year at CodeMash is teaching kids about computers and electronics. So I've help kids build lightsabers to learn basic electronics and programming IoT devices. I've taught them how to build binary clocks using Raspberry Pi Zeros. And this past year, we also 3D scanned about 50 kids' heads and 3D printed those as well.
Very cool. So can we talk a little bit more about the boot camp that you guys are doing, or what are you sort of working on from day-to-day basis? Is that primarily it, or is there additional things?
No, I'm a consultant, so I go out on site at our clients where I write Java software or architect solutions every day. And then about twice a year, we have a 6-week boot camp. And during that 6 weeks, I teach the whole first week and about half the rest of the classes. And then we have other consultants come in that are practitioners that teach the rest of their classes.
Very nice. And in addition to that, you're an author of several Java books, a Java user group leader, a Java champion. What all is involved in maintaining that active involvement in the Java community?
Well, a lot of it started when I was an independent consultant. So for about 13 years, I was independent. And as an independent, you're always concerned about what is my next assignment, my next job. And so I just got into the habit of learning stuff through podcasts, reading books, and also making a name for myself. So that got me into speaking at conferences, running the user group, and it's just continued.
And so we had talked a little bit about the topic of serverless applications. Is that one of the solutions that you find yourself using for clients?
We're starting to use it for clients, yes. I think it's still pretty early days for serverless, and organizations are just trying to figure out now where it applies. We do have some clients that are using it in the ETL space, especially, but some in the application space and some other spaces where it might work well for maybe processing large amounts of streaming data and things like that.
And that's primarily little Java applications running on AWS Lambdas, or what is that looking like?
Yeah, so all the stuff that we're doing is in AWS Lambdas, and I may use Lambdas and functions interchangeably, but it's a combination. Some of it's been in C#, some of it's been in Python, some of it's been in JavaScript. So far, none of the things that I or my consultants have worked on have been in Java, unfortunately, but that is applicable as well. Other languages include Go, JavaScript, Java, Python, C# and Go.
Very nice. Yeah, I was at Microsoft Build last year, and we were running a podcast with one of our friends from Coding Blocks, and we were talking about Azure Functions version 1 at the time and their availability and some of the side projects that we were working on. And at Ignite, they released version 2, and we had to adjust slides and adjust talking points and really kind of digest a lot of that information. It seems like this is serverless. Like you mentioned, it's still pretty early in the technology, and it seems to be evolving and growing rapidly. Have you seen a lot of changes in the AWS space, with in particular the technologies that are being utilized and any of the best practices associated?
Absolutely. I've been using AWS for probably 15 years now. I started using it quite early. And of course, at that time, it was all virtual machines that you would start up and manage yourself, or infrastructure as a service. And then platform as a service came on with Elastic Beanstalk. And now serverless is that next wave. And there's actually a service that I just recently learned about on top of AWS that turns serverless into applications as a service. So I think it's going to kind of continue to evolve, where we have the primitives that get built on top of to make our process and development that much easier. I agree with you that things change quickly. So every year, for about the last 12 years, I've been teaching some type of AWS workshop at a conference. And undoubtedly, if I wait till the night before the conference to run through it, they'll have changed so much of the interface. I'll have to do all new screenshots. And I've spent many late nights trying to catch up to the speed of changes. One of the conferences is like right after the big AWS conference. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Recently, we had someone to talk about sort of Azure Functions, and quite honestly, serverless is not something I have a ton of experience with. But is there a lot of difference between the AWS offerings and the Azure Functions? Is there a reason to choose one over the other?
Sure. Well, let me give you a broader view of the landscape. So AWS has Lambdas. Google has Google Cloud Functions. Azure has Azure Functions. Oracle has FN, which they've also open sourced, so you can run it not just inside their offering, service offering. IBM has OpenWhisk, which they've open sourced and donated to Apache. And then Pivotal also has Project Riff, which is a function as a service specifically geared towards Kubernetes. They all have similarities. They all are basically you are writing a function of code in the particular language that you're writing in. So JavaScript is the one I usually teach in, and it is just a function that you export with three parameters that get passed in, one being the context, one being the event or the data that was triggered in the event, and we can talk about some of those trigger events, and then one is a callback, which is what you're responding to it with. And so they all have a general feel. Unfortunately, one of the challenges with functions as a service is they're not compatible, so you're not going to be able to just copy and paste one or deploy it to another environment. And I also think it's important to note, too, this is not a lift and shift solution. So one of our clients came to us and said that they were going to rebuild their product, which was an ERP system in a niche environment. They wanted to get it done in 6 months, and they were going to serverless. And I immediately thought, wow, I don't know if I would take my flagship product and try to convert it to a whole new technology you've never used before in 6 months. Ultimately, they ran into some challenges and had to abandon that effort. But this is definitely a set of technologies that I think you want to take something small, like we always say, and work with something, because it's a very different model than we've worked with before. So in general, you have that function that you might write in JavaScript, and then it's going to be triggered by an event. And there's a number of events that can trigger it. So one might be receiving an email. So in AWS, you have the simple email service. So when an email comes in, you could have it respond to that and perform some type of activity. The most interesting one, I think, is CloudWatch. And CloudWatch has two services. One is looking at logs. So you can have a regular expression that says, when you see this pattern in log, invoke my function. Another one is scheduled based, like a cron. So once a day, once every hour, invoke my function. You'd also have different data sources like DynamoDB. After a record's been inserted, then you perform some type of activity. Same thing with S3. So maybe somebody uploads a file and maybe it's an image and you want to split that into multiple sizes, resolutions, formats for different consumers. You also have simple notification service and queues that you can listen to, streaming through Kinesis, and cloud formation. So anytime you execute some infrastructure to set up, you could get notified via the Lambda. But the one that's probably the most interesting and most valuable is the API gateway. So the API gateway is the way that you would expose those functions as a RESTful web service. And so a lot of people like talking about microservices, and I can't think of anything more micro than a single function that could be invoked. And then one other notable one is if you are doing stuff with Alexa and you want your Echo to respond, most oftentimes that's going to be done also with a Lambda or function.
Today's sponsor is Datadog, a cloud monitoring platform for dynamic infrastructure, distributed tracing, and logging. You can use Datadog for serverless to search, filter, and explore all your AWS Lambda functions in one place, with the ability to easily drill down into the performance of any function. Troubleshoot performance issues with distributed traces and collect custom metrics in real time to monitor key business metrics without adding any latency to your applications. See the bigger picture in the service map, which visualizes Lambda functions with all their dependencies. See how Datadog can help you handle all your applications, infrastructure, and serverless functions. Sign up for a free trial today and get your free t-shirt. Visit dtg.co/sixfigureserverless to get started.
Where would you decide to start implementing functions, Lambdas, those types of things? What are good use cases to start implementing serverless?
Sure. So I think a really good use case is the ETL one I mentioned before. So if you have data coming in and you're trying to put it into a data lake or one of the other AWS services, a perfect solution to that. So maybe somebody uploads a file to S3, the Lambda gets invoked, it separates it, puts it into the right columns in the data store. So that's a great example of one. If you're dealing with IoT devices or streaming data, it's a great way to handle the scale that you might need to that may be unpredictable. One of the nice things about the Lambdas is that they automatically scale up and scale down to your needs, and you only get charged for what you're using, which is what really differentiates it from the EC2 instances where you get charged per hour. This is you get charged for the amount of memory and time in which it runs. So oftentimes you also get much smaller costs. And so you can do something as simple. If you think about it, we often ran PHP pages just so that we could get email sent to us on the website. Well, why have a server running just for the PHP when you may get very few calls? So it could be a simple something as simple as that to running an entire web application. On the AWS podcast, they had a great example of a media site that switched from servers to serverless and cut their bill in about 10% of the original costs, and they got better scalability. So it can really scale really far down and really far up if you do it properly.
Okay, so can we talk a little bit about more of what drives the cost of functions or sort of what people are expecting? I mean, obviously, with the cloud in general, there seems to be, from my experience, that seems to be the biggest like hesitation that most clients seem to be wary of is the sort of unpredictability or unknown element of that. So being able to scale up seems to be definitely, or, you know, scale back at a very, and scale up in a very granular manner seems to be sort of like the best argument in favor of serverless. How do you sort of present that to customers?
Sure. So the cost is by time and by the amount of memory used. And so for every gigabyte used, it's 1/60,000th of a cent. Mm. So you need 60,000 gigabytes to be charged a penny. So that's pretty compelling. And then for each million requests, it's 20 cents. So you need a lot of requests in order to add up to anything really significant. But I gave you the cautionary tale of one of our potential clients before. And one of the things that they ran into that they didn't think about in their pricing model was they only looked at production runtime. Well, then they had a development team of 15, 20 people, And they use the same practice of running continuous integration every time there's a change across all the functions. Well, you're getting charged for all that. When typically, if you're running a local CI server, you know, it's one cost for one amount of time. And because this, there are ways of mocking things out, but in general, you're going to want to test it in the environment. So all of those are going to be included in your bill.
In that case, would you suggest or would it be considered good practice or bad practice to have lesser environments or lesser capable environments? Do you have the ability in AWS to crank up instances or processor speed or RAM or something that you would do so in production that you wouldn't necessarily do so in a lesser environment?
Well, you could crank down the memory. So there's a threshold of memory that you can set, and there's a length of time it can run that you can also set. And if you exceed either of those, your Lambda is just killed immediately with reckless abandon. so you could do that if you're afraid of that. You can also set thresholds not to exceed so many requests per minute or second, and to try to prevent the denial of service attack. Not that your service wouldn't support it, but the bill is how we would really refer to a denial service in this particular case. So you don't get that shock either. But I wouldn't say that those are great ways of doing it. So you might want to mock some of this stuff out. And there are frameworks that can help you build serverless, like the serverless framework at serverless.com. And one of the nice things about that framework is it supports not just AWS, but Google Cloud, Azure, OpenWhisk, and Cloudflare. And it gives you a nice command line to both compile, package, and deploy your services. And it has some mocking interfaces as well, so that you could do maybe some of the testing locally before you deploy to the environment. And there's also, Amazon has its own AWS Serverless Application Model, or SAM, which also has some of the capabilities to run some of the services outside of their cloud to reduce some of that cost as well.
What about language choice? You had mentioned a couple of different offerings, .NET and Java and JavaScript and Python, maybe Go. What would make you choose one language over another, especially being a Java developer and mentioning that you write a lot of the functions in JavaScript and haven't written any in Java? Is there a consideration there dependent on language? Is there a different functionality, or what are the concerns there?
Yeah, so that's a fantastic question. I think the number one decision maker is what language does your team know? And then outside of that, it becomes there are different performance characteristics. What I've seen over time is different languages have gotten faster. So that's kind of a moving target, which is why I start with what language does your team know? The compiled languages have historically done a little bit better because they do get compiled and deployed. But then in the case of Java, you do have the startup time of the JVM. I am hoping that once they have a Java 11 supported version, that maybe that gets better because Java 11 has reduced a lot of that startup time. So JavaScript will be a much quicker startup time, but it may be a little bit slower in the long run. And maybe this also goes into explaining a little bit more about how serverless works underneath the covers. So your application, your function is going to be deployed to a container. Think of it like a Docker container. I don't know what the underlying implementation is, but some type of container that when the first request comes in, it's going to start up that container and start up your runtime environment. And then for some period of time, as requests come in, it will get forwarded to your already constituted containers. And should traffic stop after some point in time, it will passivate that container until such time as you get more requests. So that overhead of the startup time can have a significant impact depending on what you're doing. If it's a long running that is constantly getting hit, you may get better performance from a different language. So it can depend on what you're doing.
I see.
The dynamic languages are often easier to get started too, because you can use their Cloud9 IDE built in to write the code in those languages and easily just run it right from the environment. Where if you're using something like Java, C#, you're going to have to compile it first, package it, and ship it up there to be deployable.
Earlier, you had mentioned some frameworks to help do this development, make it simpler to develop, and maybe even get some cross-platform development going. What other tools might you point people out to help simplify working with serverless applications in AWS?
Yeah, I think the serverless framework and the Amazon serverless application model are the ones that I've used and really point people to in most cases.
Okay.
From a deployment perspective, you could also use CloudFormation and Terraform. That might be, if you're already using those, might be ways to also speed up some of the development. And of course, you can always use the services like the continuous integration service and continuous deployment services and the Git repository already built into AWS. So it's all running on server side as well.
Okay. One question I had is, does AWS have any sort of hybrid solutions where we could run some part of production or part of this, like, or maybe that's the framework that you're talking about, but basically do some of the development outside of running it in the cloud, or is it pretty much everything's gotta be in the cloud?
So both serverless and the AWS application model have some capability of mocking some services, not all services. So you can do some of it, but a limited amount outside of AWS.
Okay.
You also speak quite a bit on hacking and hardening Java web applications. Is that, as we continue to evolve and adapt our development processes into more microservices and functions and more disparate applications as opposed to fewer monoliths, or what are the concerns these days on hardening web applications, whether they be Java or not, while integrating and using functions and things like that?
I think one of the biggest challenges we're seeing in cloud is people not being aware of what types of permissions they should be setting. I mean, we hear almost daily about somebody putting some file with important data out in S3 and people getting all types of valuable information from that. And unfortunately, you know, setting the permissions, the roles, all that type of stuff takes a lot of work, and it can be rather complicated. In the case of the functions, you can narrow it down to this function is only allowed to call this service in this region and that type of stuff. But I don't think organizations are locking that down nearly as much as they probably should be. Other than that, a lot of it is the same type of things that we have in any type of web development. Making sure it's under HTTPS, making sure that you are escaping your data and encoding your data properly and those types of things. One advantage I think that does happen is if somebody does breach your application and get into your server, well, it's a container and it's a very short-lived container. So they're probably not going to be able to get much damage done in a short period of time. So there are some advantages, but most of it's the same type of stuff that we see over and over again.
What about for a broader web application stance? Is it just following OWASP top 10 recommendations, or is there more to it than that? Is it protecting your secrets and your keys and rotating those and making sure you have valid certificates? Or what other items should developers be aware of and practice these days?
So it is definitely all of that. And I would say, don't just focus on the OWASP top 10. I mean, that is like table stakes. OWASP has an application model, security model document that it goes way more in depth than that. And you should be looking at that, but perform regular scans. So I'm a big fan of Zap, the from OWASP, and I like to run that all the time. And I think getting security training is really important from different instructors and over again. I know as I started to learn security, I was able to identify a lot more issues than I had prior to that. And I thought I was a good, secure developer with, you know, 23 years of experience now. I thought I knew what I was doing. And as I learned more, I realized, wow, for years I've been making very simple, common mistakes. And now I'm able to spot things a lot quicker. And now I do have more confidence. And then I run the tools on top of it to do the scanning. And that validates that the software I'm writing is getting better and better. But even the tools don't cover everything. So continuous learning, continuous applying, I think are the biggest things, really.
So what are the couple pitfalls, the most common, either most egregious or most common that you see that people are just missing?
So on my last application, believe it or not, I found a SQL injection. You know, we often think that that's a solved problem. And when we use frameworks like Hibernate or Entity Framework, that those frameworks are using best practices and that they are using prepared statements, and they probably are. But oftentimes there's a way to get around that to solve certain problems. And in this one particular case, a senior developer, even more senior than I am, was concatenating a ascending-descending flag from a table. And the way he did it introduced a SQL injection vulnerability. Another simple example is I was giving a class one time and I was talking about forking a process. And in the case of Java, we're lucky that the process class does not allow, the way it tokenizes it, it's hard to do a SQL an injection into the operating system or a command line unless you use the word bash. And somebody in the group got up and left. And later I was like, where did you go? And he said, as soon as you said bash, I realized I had just done that a couple hours ago and I better go check. And sure enough, it was vulnerable. So I cleaned it up. So it can be really simple things like that. But I think a lot of the time, it's just not putting in the security controls. So the request comes in and not checking. Does this person really have permissions or rights to perform this activity? That's probably the one I see most often. And I would like to see more behavior-driven tests where they check even before they write any code that, hey, this user should be able to get this page or should be able to submit this type of data. And I think if we did that up front, that would solve a lot of those problems. And that's one that the scanning tools aren't going to find. I mean, there was just in the last couple of months, a mortgage company that was vulnerable just by people guessing a ID. And next thing you know, they have all types of information because mortgages have your driver's license, your bank account routing number, everything about you pretty much to get that loan. Having those simple checks can make a really big improvement.
So speaking of those scanning tools, is that something that you sort of have a team run either periodically or do you like integrate Zaps into CI/CD? What have you found to be like a really good success practice?
So most often it's been a developer just running about every 6 months or so. But ideally, and we've done this on some small cases, having it be a part of the continuous integration environment. And you can set up Zap as a proxy. And so you could have your QA team using that proxy, walking through the application so you get every page, collect that, and then nightly run the test against all those to do it more frequently. That would be the ideal scenario.
Okay. How about running against production? So this is another thing that I have seen personally is, some companies even just basically turning these scanning tools on directly against production. What do you have any thoughts on the benefits of that or the pitfalls there?
So you have to be really, really careful because if you enable some tests like the SQL injection test, it's going to inject a whole bunch of bad data, even if you're not susceptible, because it's going to be trying to test all those different scenarios. So I usually recommend not doing that. If you can get away with it, have some other safe environment where if the data gets munged, you can blow that environment away and start up a new one.
Well, one of the things we ask everyone that we invite on to basically provide some words of wisdom to maybe people getting started or people that are just trying to level up in their career. Do you have any sort of pieces of advice that you might sort of speak to those individuals?
Sure. So for the senior person, my recommendation is to diversify a little bit. And what I mean there is I like to read one book a month, and I like to spend 8 to 10 hours listening to podcasts. And my diversification has been to add to my technology mix business and leadership books so that it's not all just technology. And I think oftentimes we forget that the business is really important to what we're doing. And the more senior you get, the more important that business is. So that would be my recommendations to them. I feel like for people just coming into the industry, I know this may sound counter to what a lot of people are recommending, but I highly recommend people get their four-year, two-year degree. I don't think a degree is necessary for programming, but the competition that they're going to be up against is people with degrees. I think from the interviews I do, and I do about 100 interviews of young people each year, and in that process, I get to see a wide variety of skill sets, and the people who are self-taught, maybe go through some coding schools, are lacking in some areas. And I think the ones that are self-taught, they don't have a good direction of what they should be learning. And they usually jump around a whole bunch of places and then don't have a strong foundation. The coding schools, from my experience, just it's not long enough to really get the skills necessary. They tend to be very, very thin. And some of them have been very successful with that, but I think that tends to be a smaller group. So I recommend that two, but especially four-year degree. And based on the math I've done, it also goes to a coding school. You get about 480 hours of writing code technical stuff. A two-year degree is about 680 hours, and a four-year degree is about 1,400 hours. And so when you think about the whole idea of it takes, the conventional wisdom is 10,000 hours to become an expert. If you get that four-year degree, you're significantly further in the process. I also know that there is a big concern about the cost of college, and it is a big cost, but I just saw some numbers that show that the average person coming out of a four-year degree has about $8,000 in debt. And if you look at most of the coding schools, it's as big, if not bigger, than that coming out of it. So if you are going to be challenged to find a job, because you don't have the degree, I think it might be worth it to spend less, may take a little bit more time. And then the last part of that is if you are going to a coding school, even a 2 or 4 year degree, my recommendation is to go find 5 companies you want to work for at the end. Look at the job ruts out there. Find out what technologies they're using. That can help you decide which one of the coding schools you might attend that will match those. Even ask them, do they hire people out of the coding school before you go through all that work, time, and money? And then same thing for the 2 and 4 year degrees, because you'll have electives along the way. If you've looked at what those jobs are hiring, you can do a better choice of getting the electives so that when you actually then graduate, you're better aligned. And then finally, for everybody, I recommend contributing to open source. I think there are so many huge advantages to that. And I hear people say all the time, I'm not good enough, which I find interesting, because if you're not good enough to contribute to open source for free, why are you asking me for a job where I'm going to pay you to do the work? So, you know, you get to work on a bigger code base than you probably have in any educational environment. And it can also lead to a great opportunity that maybe there are employers out there looking, like maybe the ones who may be supporting those projects, looking for people to hire. And how much is it better to go into an interview and say, not only do I know this, have I used this framework, but I've contributed to it as well. So I know a little bit deeper even than my competition.
Yeah, those are excellent. They're very, very unique and very applicable, piece of advice. And then what about if someone wants to follow you? Do you have any social media or Twitter? Where can they find you?
So I'm at Java Judd on Twitter and LinkedIn, Christopher M. Judd. Those are the two places I do most of my messaging. And you can also go to javajudd.net to see my website where I list conferences I'll be speaking at.
Speaking of those, do you know any of the upcoming speaking engagements that you might have?
Yep. I have 2 engagements with Get With It, which is a women's conference. I have Dog Food Conf and then 2 No Fluff Just Stuffs, Art Conf and Tech Leader Summit, coming up in December. And I'm really excited about those two because I'm going to reach a new milestone of 100 conferences in my career speaking at.
Fantastic.
And having just caught one of your presentations at Codepalooza this past week, really enjoyed it. So I highly recommend anyone out there that comes across any conferences you're speaking at, absolutely sit in and enjoy.
Thank you so much.
That was Christopher Judd. Chris is CTO and partner at Manifest Solutions, author, Java user group leader, Java champion, trusted technical advisor, and talent developer.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Nash.